Hey there, oh there, you're listening to Super Tool Shed, the only podcast on the internet where one of the host keyboards broke during a power failure.
Guess which one?
I'm Bennett the Sage, I'm joined by Mark the Engineer, and today is a lazy Sunday evening for the both of us. So consider this episode the junk drawer episode, where Mark connects his previous Nintendo rant with his sure-to-be-next one. But first, the pleasantries. Mark, how have you been?
My keyboard broke.
We've already established that. You're going to have to share with us a little bit more than that.
Oh, why you got to be all douchey about it?
Well, you volunteered for the talking stick. Talk.
All right. So we've had a lot of power failures across Philadelphia due to the frigid cold weather and the fact that we have trees with varying other issues and Pico Energy. I don't know. Maybe being somewhat not good at their jobs. We'll never know. But yeah, today we had a power failure out of nowhere. So normally that doesn't really make a big deal for me. I lost a little bit of work, but at first I didn't kind of realize that. And when I did, it didn't really piss me off as much as it should have, for reasons that I'll talk about a little bit later. And we get the power back and I turn everything on. First thing that happens is my main board is like, yeah, I don't know how many cores you're supposed to have, so I'm going to give you two. Yeah, no, we gotta fix that. And when I got to the end of that, and Windows finally sorted out everything that it's meant to sort out during these sort of situations, I noticed that my keyboard wasn't working. So that became, alright, reinstall keyboard driver. No. Plug it into every single USB port. No. Reinstall USB host controller. No. Plug in shitty Dell keyboard that I keep in mothballs? Yes! Oh. Fuck me. So that's it. My SciTech Cyborg V7, which has been a trooper for quite a few years now, has finally decided that it wants to be dead as a doornail. And that makes me sad because I'm not a big fan of gaming keyboards. And that's kind of why it is that we started up doing Toolshed 1, because we haven't done one in a good amount of time now. So we don't have to do it back to back, just on the count that Bill Rogers decides to show up in my basement, and,
What, don't you keep him in your basement? I thought we all have our Bill Rogers closet.
No, because then I'd have to feed him, and I can't afford that on a new media salary, okay? So, I can barely afford to feed me on a new media salary, are you fucking kidding?
I just keep him in the closet and he just pulls a Renfield and just finds crickets or something.
That's it. That's the new diet. Forget the paleo diet. Just start locking fucks in your closet. Just consent to being taken hostage and you will lose weight in no time.
You'll lose all love for humanity, but you'll have a killer six pack.
And a wicked beard.
And all the ladies love that pale look.
Yeah, that pale, haven't seen the sun, totally forgot how to socialize look, where you sort of look and say, like, did the bomb go off?
I would imagine that'd be a problem for you.
You know, what was weird was I was talking to my mom today about the power failure, and, like, because I woke up like a shot, and this is just sort of, this is a small left turn, people, I promise. Where since I'm Generation Y, since I'm very much used to the white noise that is our day-to-day lives now, you know, the hum of my computer fans and the sound of central heating and all this other stuff, that when all that white noise is gone and when you have deafening silence, it's strange. It's disconcerting. Like, you hear it in your sleep. It's so loud and it's quiet. And I find that really interesting now, and I wonder how many people genuinely need that subconscious white noise in order to maintain a sense of normal as they sleep.
Well, I don't think that's a generational thing. I mean, there's this quietest room in the world, and people can only stand to be in there for about 37 minutes because the sound of your organs moving and doing their job will drive anyone insane.
Mm.
If it gets too quiet, you get the panic. That's just a natural instinct. Like, even when we were in the cavemen, we were always listening to, like, the wind through trees or the rustling of leaves because we need sound to know where we are.
I want one of those extreme corset people to go into the quietest room in the world and then unzip their corset. Because, like, you know about those, about
oh, the, yeah,
real hardcore, like, corset enthusiasts that are like, I can get myself down to 6 inches.
And, oh, yeah, when their liver's up where their heart is and their bladder's somewhere near their knee.
Yeah, and they say that they can feel their organs moving. And it's like, yeah, I want to know what that sounds like in the quietest room of the world.
I think that sounds basically like, fuck you. Fuck you.
Yeah, if you ever needed a definition of the word squelch, it would probably be the noise made by an extreme corseter in the quietest room of the world. So back on the main highway, so the reason why it is that I have such a problem with my keyboard being busted is because I don't know about you, gentle audience, but I am not a fan of Electric Blue. The reason why it is that I bought the Cyborg V7 when it first came out was because it had a fully programmable backlight set. And on day one, I made it red and never changed it. When I built my original rig and I decided I wanted lit fans, and this was like two rigs ago, red lights, and never changed them. I am not a fan of Electric Blue. I am not a fan of Ghostbusters Slimer Nuclear Green. I like black and red. That's the color of the flag of Neartopia. You know, like that's
also Nazi colors.
You know what? You can read into that as much as you fucking want. I mean, because you can peg me for so many things: grammar Nazi, word Nazi, script Nazi, gaming culture Nazi, social aspect of gaming Nazi.
And the Nintendo fanboys are your Jews. I mean, let's not mince words here. I mean, like, when you get, like, your anger boner raging against anything, and specifically few things in this world like Nintendo fanboys, you have this way of expelling hatred.
I'll admit,
and expelling vile, bilious words.
I was two whiskeys in at that in the last episode. I'll admit it. and that doesn't necessarily deflate how I felt, because I didn't get the buzz on until the show was really over. But someone did tweet me. Someone tweeted me and said, you know, like, I understand where you're coming from, but that was really over the top. And I realized that it was over the top again at Left Turn. Like, I realized it was somewhat over the top in the way that I was speaking about how it is that I feel about Nintendo and the way that they do business. But, like, honestly, I just feel like, you know, just because something's cute doesn't mean it can't chainsaw your family. Okay? Like, that's it. And you can cite Nintendo as being the biggest, friendliest, happiest fucking company hiding behind the fattest, nicest plumber in the fucking world. But the fact is that they are evil. They are clearly evil in how it is that they have gone about their business in the last 10 years. And people should make complaints about that. They should, you know, stand up, be counted. It's not a matter of walking away from Nintendo as the hardcore. It's a matter of saying, I grew up a hardcore gamer on a Nintendo console. I want that back. So, but again, this is supposed to be connective tissue between my last Nintendo rant and my next Nintendo rant, and there's not supposed to be this in between. So, black and red are my colors for a keyboard, and I have a problem with the marketing of gaming in the sense that, you know, fucking Razer dominates now. And what's Razer's colors? Fucking blue and green. And I don't want a blue backlit keyboard. It's just, like, because blue... Here's something else. I don't know if this is something that's a matter of people with glasses or if it's just like a me thing or if it's a select people thing, but blue lights fuck with my eyes. So when I'm looking directly at a blue light, it doesn't matter whether it's my alarm clock that you can see in the background and Violence Jack or, you know, like looking at a blue sign for like Pet Boys or something like that. Whenever it is I'm looking directly at a blue light in a dark space, if I move my head, that light, that blue object, actually moves around. And that doesn't affect my depth of field, but it just sort of annoys the crap out of me.
That almost sounds hallucinatory, if you ask me.
I don't know what it is, but I can do it on command, no matter what state I'm in. Like, so long as it's dark and it's a bright blue light that's, you know, like blue, like, say, the blue of a keyboard or the blue of my alarm clock, whenever I move my eyes around or when I move my head around while keeping my eyes focused on that blue light, everything, like, the light moves around with this parallax effect, which is weird. So I'm not digging that, and I most certainly don't want that on my desk.
I have no strong feeling about, like, the color of keyboard. I never really saw the point of that. I mean, I see an appeal of that in the same way that certain people feel the need to put, like, a rear spoiler on their car, even though they will never touch 100 miles per hour.
Okay, two things. One, I need to apologize to the internet for making you a car guy.
Wait, when you talk about your car, you talk about, you know, Top Gear, you can't help but turn people onto it, especially if you can make it entertaining. Yeah. And I, like you, could take an interest in something mechanical and something tangible. If you really abstract it, what is the difference between a computer and a car? Bunch of different machines working in unison to make something.
It's true. But I still need to apologize to the internet. Like, if there's anybody who wondered why it is that Bennett's references went from baseball to cars.
Yes. I still do baseball references, mofo.
Yeah, but there haven't been too many baseball references in the show lately. It's been cars. We've just been doing a lot of car jokes. So that's my fault. Second, I did see a Nissan 350Z with like a 5-foot spoiler on it. It was white with gray camo vinyl on it. And the worst fucking look at me, I need downforce in the worst kind of way spoiler I've ever seen, where it's like, guy, you've got a semi ugly car to begin with, and somehow you found a way to make it worse.
It's like a bowling shoe with wings.
And I can't, I always feel bad when I say that the 350 is an ugly car, but because it's a car of legacy, you know, it's a car of pedigree and legacy, but it's kind of like, I'm sorry if you own one in the audience, but it's fucking ugly. The 350 is ugly, the 370 is uglier, and I'm sorry, but really the only reason why you bought a 350 or a 370 is because you can't afford a GTR, so... keep playing Forza and live the dream, you know, like that's bad.
Let's explore this a little bit. I think we've already established your really disdain for the fact that fate has dealt you a broken keyboard.
Yeah.
It sounds to me that there's something here about you and your relationship with Nissan.
No, there really isn't, because I've driven a lot of Nissans, you know, between... Like, over the course of my life, like, I like the Altima as a, you know, cheap and cheerful car. The Maxima's okay, so long as it's a new Maxima, because old Maximas are just shitty little crap boxes. And, I don't know, like, Nissan has made some really pretty cars, but there is something about the shape, like, the shape in profile of the 350 and the 370 that just... is really ugly. And the 370, the way it looks now with projector headlights, it's got these beady little eyes and these not quite Dodge Viper from the show Viper teeth. It's just kind of ugly looking to me. So and it's not like I'm saying like I drive the prettiest car in the world. I don't.
No, I've seen the car you drive.
Eat it.
Has a legacy behind it. I won't deny you that. But if I sat in their car again, I would probably need to wear a hazmat suit. I don't know what it is with people that decide that their car needs to hold everything they own in them, especially when they have a small car like you.
All right, look, I'll admit that I didn't clean my car. I didn't have time to clean my car when I saw you. I had driven down to see Bennett when he was over here for Elise's wedding, and I had no time to do anything. I had to make a snap decision as to whether or not I was going to go in one direction or go and see Bennett. So I didn't clean out my car. I didn't have time to clean out my car. And I'm still in the process of rebuilding my car, which is up to and including reupholstering the car. So okay, you're cool. Talking about a car that has 20-year-old carpet in it. And
Is like the, if I have to, I hate to interrupt you here, but one of my pet peeves is everyone talks about how lovely the new car smell is, but nobody talks about the horrific, death-inducing stench of old carpet upholstery in cars. Yeah. It is one of the worst smells you'll ever have in your entire life. And it's everywhere.
It is. And honestly, like, I'm not above it. And, this would be the second time I've had to reupholster a Firebird, because I had one when I was 17. And it's not like it's hard. It's just that it takes a lot of time, because you have to take the seats out. You have to take the center console out. You have to tear up the old carpet. You have to make sure that you fill any holes that are in the floor pans. After you do that, now you're talking about, well, I'm sitting on this 20-year-old car, and all I hear is road noise and exhaust. Like, you heard what my car sounds like. So now it's, okay, well, now that I got the seats out, the center console out, the carpet out, throw the carpet away, I need DynaMat to insulate the car from sound and weather. So now that's more money that I sure as shit don't have. So the only the primary reason why it is that I haven't reupholstered the car by now, even though I had it for the entire summer last summer and plenty of time to do it, was money. It costs a lot of money to reupholster a car, especially if you're going to reupholster, if you're going to refinish the cab with DynaMat and then put carpet on top of that and reupholster the seats. It's just a shit ton of money that I do not have. So it's kind of this slow patchwork, like buying sod for your lawn 12 by 12 at a time sort of process.
Well, then again, this was the process that you knew you were getting yourself into when you bought the car in the first place.
Yeah, and now that you know that that's the process, stop your bitching. You don't even have a car.
No, but I will bitch if I have to be inside your car again. I mean, I'm sorry. I hate to be a disrespectful guest, especially when you were so courteous when you were over here. But actually, you were... You were above being courteous. You were like a self-cleaning robot when you were over at my house.
Yeah, I was totally a Roomba all over your house. Washing dishes. I didn't want... Because here's my thing. Like so many nerds that entertain, because my persistence about entertaining is that there has to be something massively fucked up with you if you want to say something like, I want to entertain for a living. I want to pretend for a living. And part of my fucked upness is the fact that I try and leave a really small footprint wherever I go, whenever I leave my house. So I am not in the habit of making dishes. If I am, I'm going to make sure you don't know I did. I don't want to sleep in your guest bed. I don't want to use your blankets. I will use my trench coat as a blanket if I have to. I will sleep on the floor. You know, like I seriously, if I could get away with it, I would just sleep in a corner, eat nothing, and shit never whenever I'm at someone else's house.
You're Al Gore's wet dream, man.
Seriously, man, my personal footprint would be zero if I could help it, but I just try and keep it as small as humanly possible.
And as somebody who has to maintain my living space when I get guests over, having someone like that is very appreciative. I mean, I appreciate the effort that you went through, but at the other end of the spectrum, you have to understand that that looks really fucking weird.
Yeah, I know.
I mean, like, I understand, like, you wanting to wash the dishes that you use. It's like, yeah, that's very helpful and very kind of you to do so. Wouldn't ask you to do it, but thank you all the same. But then you started cleaning the dishes that weren't even involved in the making of the meal. That was just... Huh?
Look, I don't know what to tell you. It's, you know, I'm an awesome house guest because I make no fuss and I'm low maintenance. I'm an awesome con guest for that same reason, where convention staff, they'll ask me, because they're used to, you know, like,
I want hot and cold running volunteers all day and night.
I knew you couldn't resist it. I knew you couldn't resist the comparison.
But the thing is that for me and con staff, when they're offering me all this stuff, they're like, are you hungry? Are you thirsty? Can we go out and get you food, booze, whatever? I'm like, look, I drove here. I'm really low maintenance. If I need something, I can hop in my car, go get it. In fact, I'm going to ask you if you need anything. And that was my first really big experience having that happen was at Anime Next, where the person who runs the green room, her name is Kathy. And she's a beautiful person and a wonderful friend and has been forever now. And she is the most accommodating person. She is con mom. Like, you will see her name under, you know, like, world's greatest con moms. And I drive her nuts because I will not let her do anything for me. She demands that I eat food. And I'm like, no, I'm not eating food. I'm just going to wait until I can, like, I'm going to pull my own weight. I'm going to eat my own food. I don't need a per diem. I don't need your money. I'm like, I'm here and I'm so happy to be here. So you don't have to give me things. Stop giving me things. And
I will evolve photosynthesis to avoid having to take food from you.
Seriously, like over the course of an anime next weekend, as far as the green room's concerned, I will maybe eat one sandwich and drink a metric fuck ton of coffee. But beyond that, man, I am nowhere near the person that is, like, demanding of the con staff in any way. Because I'm like, look, you volunteered because you love this, and I am not going to be the person that makes you hate this.
Let that be some other guy.
Yeah, let that be some other guy who's probably totally on your marquee. You know, like, that is not going to be me. When you think back on Mark Swint, you're going to go, you know, that Mark Swint was a pretty cool guy. He bought me a beer. You know, like, that's, like, he bought me a beer and he helped clean up the green room after we were all done at the Dead Dog. Like, that's the kind of person that I want to be at cons. That's the person that I want to be in life, where I want to go forth and be helpful and not demand and not really ask, even though people would prefer that I ask, because people, you know, they want to accommodate you. But the thing is that when you're kind of like, I'll say that it comes from a small place if I'm not worth it. But when you kind of feel that way, you just kind of go like, look, I just kind of want to make everybody else happy and make sure everybody else is having a good time. And that's, I guess that's kind of why it is that I'm the engineer, because I have no show, but everyone comes to me and I'm like, if you need me for something, I can make it a little bit better. And that's all I do. Meanwhile, when people ask me, do you have a show? Like, nope.
Oh, and hence why we changed your credit title to script supervisor on Anime Abandoned.
No, we changed my credit title to script supervisor because you forgot to put my name in the goddamn credits twice in a row.
Oh, come on! Jesus fucking Christ. All right, enough about you. I mean, albeit we started this recording just to placate your need to expel all this pent-up frustration because of your broken keyboard, but I have made history. I made an honest-to-goodness Chicago deep-dish pizza, and it is one of the greatest. It was one of the greatest pies I've ever had in my life. It was just so much goodness piled on top of another. It was happiness in a slice, is what it was. It was bar none one of the best pies I've ever had, and I was proud of myself for making it all the way from the dough.
And this was after I told you multiple times, like, yeah, I've got this great recipe. You should try this. Now I got this great dough recipe. You should try this or this or this. And then finally, you just kind of come to me and like, I'm going to do it. I'm going to do it today. Today's the day. Like you were going to propose or something. Just like spray it. Let's splay out all the ingredients, your flour, your yeast, your cornmeal, your water, your sugar, right in there. And you're just like, ingredients, would you do me the honor of coming together into a dough for me, please?
Well, you have to understand that I'm on a diet, and one of the things that is a big, big no-no is dough of any kind because of the carbs. So me building this Chicago deep dish pizza was basically a treat for me for losing 15 pounds. So I got a 9-inch cake pan, just got this nice buttery spongy dough, just laid it all out there, get some nice, nice mozzarella. Get some nice pepperoni and sausage, another layer of mozzarella, and finally, one of the best pizza sauces that I've ever tasted. And it wasn't really so much a sauce. It was basically I used petite diced tomatoes instead of chopped up tomatoes. And the sauce came out of like this, almost like a very thick, chunky, kind of like a paste. And I made this with my friend Gabe and my dad around, and they didn't think too much of the pizza sauce while it was cooking. It's like, well, won't it seep through? It's like, no, have faith. Have faith that this will come together to make a pie worth talking about tomorrow morning. And that's exactly what happened. I pulled it out. It was almost Herculean having to pull that pie out of the oven. You wouldn't expect a pie to look as heavy, I mean, to feel as heavy as it looks, but it was just, you know, you drop it on the counter, it cracks, that kind of heft. And we got it out, sliced it all up, and you could only eat like a quarter of the pie before you were just like tapping out, but you tapped out knowing that you just, it was almost like a victory lap after you eaten that slice of pie. It was.
And you put, I mean, this, like you put this lead ball in your body.
You put this lead ball in your body. It tasted incredible. And it feels like if you died at that moment, you would have no regrets. Like, all your enemies have been slain. Your legacy is secure. You do not need to be on this earthly realm any longer, for you will never achieve anything as great as what you have achieved right now.
And that's that partially what we've been up to.
I mean, I know it sounds like I'm over-exaggerating about this pie, but, like, if I opened a pizza restaurant and I just made those pizzas for the rest of my life, I would be happy. Because I knew that I would be serving people really, really great food. And, you know, where I live, we don't have a pizza place that like that. I mean, we have pizza places, we have great pizza places, but we can't, there's no place where you can get a good deep dish pizza.
Yeah, the best you get is fucking Chuck E. Cheese's pizza.
Oh, come on!
It tastes like Chuck E. Cheese's pizza. I'm not saying that's a bad thing, but I am saying that Chuck E. Cheese's is a polarizing fucking pizza. It is. Parents hate it, kids love it, and for some reason, when I got older and I started finding all these places that made pizza exactly the same way, I kind of went, you know, this is still pretty good. It's not nearly as horrifying as parents make it out to be. Which maybe, you know, comes from that sense of nostalgia. Like, nostalgia makes everything taste better. But as far as I'm concerned, Chuck E. Cheese still makes a okay pizza. Not a great pizza. Better than Pizza Hut. Better than Domino's. Not better than Papa John's. No. But, you know, so when you took me to that place, I was just kind of like, yeah, well, it tastes like Chuck E. Cheese's pizza, which means that it gets the okay grade, not the great, not the amazing, most certainly not worth the you leaning forward and staring at me as I was eating it. But
well, this whole conversation started with our rant, well, our conversation slash argument about New York pizza. And it came down to the fact that, you know, I was watching The Daily Show, and then that segment topped. And it came on where John Stewart just completely went off the rails about New York pizza and versus Chicago pizza. And, you know, being to Chicago and having, I believe it was Giordano's. Yeah, it was Giordano's pizza. And me being thoroughly impressed by that pie, I say, like, what the hell are you talking about? And then you chimed in with a conversation about, like, the soul of pizza making and the character of pizza making. And
I'm talking about the character of pizza making in terms of, like, you know, like what we're used to on the East Coast versus what you're used to on the West Coast, which is, as far as I'm concerned, a far more manufactured everything. Like, really, like the further you go west, the more manufactured and fake shit gets. Just, you don't believe me, walk around LA for a minute and try and pick out whose tits are real.
First off, that's Los Angeles. You cannot judge the entirety of the West Coast by its biggest city alone. All right, that would be like me saying, like, oh, the East Coast is filled with idiots because over half the population on the East Coast is in Florida. It's true.
But I mean, it was a worthy conversation. It was a worthy debate. Shamefully, not one that we had on Toolshed, not one that I'm willing to dig up right now. But
but the crux of my argument was that the one thing I hate about New York pizza isn't so much the pizza itself. I mean, I'll eat any pizza you put in front of me. You know, I'll judge it by, like, other pizzas that I've had, but, you know, what they say is true. There's no such thing as bad pizza. What I hate and what I really detest so much about New York pizza is,
like, hold on, wait, pin in that. There is such a thing as bad pizza. Whenever you get a pizza and it fucking reeks, like the cheese, like the cheese has been out too long or something.
I'll admit that that is at least edible. That is at least edible.
If you can eat that, more power to you. Because whenever I get a fucking smelly ass pizza, and you can taste how it smells, I'm like, nope. Either tear the cheese off or throw it away. I cannot do this. I can't put this in my body. There is something wrong with this pizza.
There is a lake of grease in the middle of it.
There's a lake of grease in the middle of it. It smells like ass, and I can guarantee you that no amount of McDonald's eaten over a course of 24 hours would produce the same amount of shit that this pizza would if I consumed it in its entirety.
That reminds me of Straw Hat Pizza. Edible, but you wouldn't, like, if you say, let's go out for pizza, it's like, hey, why don't we get Straw Hat? Punch that person right in the face.
Yeah, seriously, like, whenever someone says that something's edible, I'm like, motherfucker, shit is edible. All right?
As long as it's out of the human asshole, then yeah.
Like edible is the ability to eat something. Like, you can put it in your mouth, chew it, digest it, and pass it. Like, that's, like, yeah, gobstoppers are edible, but that doesn't mean that they're necessarily good or good for you. You know, like, you can swallow a gobstopper whole and pass a mostly whole gobstopper. Like, do you regret that decision as you're sitting on the bowl? Probably. You know, so, like, you're sucking on a jawbreaker, on a big-ass jawbreaker, someone pats you on the back, you fucking swallow it somehow.
Then all of a sudden, like, 2 days later, you're doing your business, and all of a sudden you hear a plink in the toilet bowl, and it's like, oh, so that's where that went.
Uh-huh. So, and it manages to pass the amount of change and string that is in the average American's gut, but
yeah, I will concede the fact that although there are edible pizzas, there are pizzas that you wouldn't want to eat.
Yeah, there is pizza that I would just never touch again. Like, there's a chain in Delaware called Grotto Pizza, which all by itself, the name.
I mean, why would you call your place Grotto Pizza? The word grotto itself just...
Yeah, ugh. Exactly. Like, you hear the word grotto and you don't really think of good things. You think of muck and grime and, you know, whatever strippers on Hugh Hefner's payroll. Like, you don't think of good things. And, like, this pizza is just the single worst pizza I have ever had consistently in my entire life, where... I was seeing someone at the time, and she lived in Delaware, and I, like, and her family was big into Grotto Pizza, like, it was the best fucking thing on earth, even though they did make their own pizza. And whenever they would get Grotto, they'd be like, Mark, you hungry? Nope. Nope, I'm good. Like, I'll eat at Wawa. I'm fine. That's like a fucking high-class restaurant by comparison to Grotto Pizza. I will totally eat a Wawa hoagie instead.
What is with this pizza? I mean, you make it out to sound like... The crust is made out of chewed bubblegum.
It was just the convergence of all the worst things you can possibly imagine in terms of a pizza going wrong. The sauce is barely there in terms of a taste. It may as well just be fucking ketchup. The crust is just like split top bread, and the cheese bubbled like it does on an Elio's pizza, where you just kind of look at an Elio's pizza that came out of the microwave and go, you know, I think that this pizza has some kind of terminal illness. So, yeah, Grotto was just the absolute center point, the epicenter of everything that can possibly go wrong with a pizza, short of the person who's making it, taking it out of the oven, dropping trowel, and pooing on it.
Well, getting back to my main point about New York pizza is everyone's viewpoint of it. Like, it's the paragon of how pizza should be. And to me, there's no one way to make a pizza, let alone the New York style of making pizza, which I personally do not like. I don't like a cracker thin crust. I don't like these greasy, floppy triangles.
No, like bread with fucking sauce and cheese on it. That's what you like.
I like something substantial.
See, you call it substantial, but really, you just like a Kaiser roll with sauce and cheese on it. You like a pizza sandwich.
Which, you know, you go back to the point of you, like, giving me my first Stromboli for the first time. The
not Stromboli, Inside Out, which some of you might know as the Panzerotti.
Excuse me. And yeah, you go back to that, giving me that, and I really liked it because I liked the dough, I liked the ingredients, I liked the cheese, I liked everything about it. So there was, you know, that gets the thumbs up, A grade for me. But when you go to like New York style pizza, and believe me, I had all types of New York style pizza. Never been to New York, but and here's the part of my argument where
this is where your argument totally fucking falls down, that you've never been to New York.
I've never been to New York, but if you think for one fucking moment that you have to go to New York to get New York style pizza, fuck you. There is no reason why you can't get New York pizza outside of New York and have it be inauthentic.
For the same reason that you can't get New York style pizza outside of New York, it's the same reason why it is that you think you know what a Philly cheesesteak is and you've never been to Philadelphia.
Because the ingredients are not specific to Philadelphia.
You know, you say, like, it might, like, it's not even about the ingredients in all cases. Sometimes it's about the preparation. Like, Jim's will make a steak different from Pat's, will make a different steak from Gino's, will make a different steak than Wawa. Like, Wawa sells a cheesesteak, and what it is a long roll with boiled fucking beef on it, and then your choice of cheese, which... That's not a cheese. That's a cheesesteak by definition. And I see places all the time that are like authentic Philly cheesesteak. It's like, really? I'm nowhere near Philadelphia right now. I really would like to be the judge of that, but I don't feel like wasting my money.
Or wasting all my time eating cheese whiz.
But that's the thing though, is that the authentic cheesesteak technically has cheese whiz on it. Now, me personally, I prefer the plain steak to the cheesesteak just because I don't like putting a shit ton of cheese in any kind in my body. I'm not a dairy person. But still, you know, whenever you see like authentic Philly cheesesteak and you're in California, just you're guaranteed that unless you can get proof that the person prepping that cheesesteak was born in Philadelphia, you're not going to get an authentic cheesesteak, like an authentic Philly style cheesesteak. It's simply not going to happen. And maybe that comes down to the preparation. Same thing for New York. That could come down to the preparation. That's the argument. Again, the argument that I don't necessarily feel like having, but I've been dragged into it kicking and screaming to defend my coast. because Mr. Relaxed and Groovy, Mr. Flip-Flops and fucking Hemp Necklace over here wants to start talking about how Kaiser rolls with sauce and cheese on them are superior to an authentic New York-style pizza.
Authentic New York-style fucking pizza. Jesus fucking Christ. You can import the flour, you can import the water, you can import the sauce, you can import the cheese.
Well, I mean, they're already scientifically proven that the water has nothing to do with why it is that New York bagels are so superior to bagels everywhere else. But they still can't figure out why it is that bagels in New York are so much better than bagels everywhere else, which has to come down to preparation. So that would mean that as far as pizza goes, New York style pizza prepared in New York would be down to preparation. Same thing
but
for the cheesesteak.
To do with the region, that has to do with the people.
Yeah, and that would be an entirely different kind of people. The fact is that a person who wants to talk a problem out with me can't make a pizza better than the guy who would totally want to punch me out for taking his parking space. Period. All right? You fucking non-confrontational assholes who never fucking get into fights ever, and everything's all relaxed and groovy. Meanwhile, us all here on the East Coast are just like, look, I'll sell you fucking pizza because I need to eat, but the fact is that you parked in my parking space, so your pizza's gonna have cheese, sauce, crust, and blood on it. You know?
This confrontational attitude towards pizza is part of the reason why I don't like New York style pizza. Like, if anyone says, like, hey, this is really good pizza,
you can
yes.
feel the malice. You can
like, I can feel the malice. It's like, it's no New York style pizza. Fuck you!
every bite.
New York style pizza, asshole! It's like, if you say that, if you have ever said that in your entire life, you deserve a brick to the face.
Ah, see, there's some East Coast sentimentality right there.
There is an East Coast sentimentality. And I'll be the one to throw it at you. You see, this is the why I can make good pizza, because I got an East Coast mentality without the East Coast fucking superiority complex.
Oh my God.
I love making my dough, I love making my sauce, I love making my pizza. And if I want to make a deep dish, fuck you, it's my pizza. You don't get to have any.
And see, it is that anger right there that makes your pizza taste superior to pizza made by some fucking asshole who just wants to talk it out.
So, like, I will make my pizza. I will serve it to anyone I like because they want to eat good fucking pizza. Not because they live in fucking New York, and not even because they live in fucking Chicago.
I don't know. Like, maybe you can. I mean, I'm really sorry to the audience if we're making you hungry, but this is just kind of an interesting line of conversation. I don't know. Like, when you think about some of the best food, doesn't it come from some of the most confrontational places?
I think so. Like, some of the best, like, kielbasa and some of, like, a real, like, real sausage. Not like that Johnsonville bratwurst shit. We're talking, like, you go to some, like
Bill Schwartzky super fans fucking sausage.
Yeah, like the kind of, like, a Chicago super fan they would try to belch up if they had too much beer. That kind of sausage. Are always from, like, the most, like, the grittiest areas of the most Polish areas of Chicago, where they don't even speak English. That's where you get that. And it's not because they're Polish. It's because they know how to make it good. They just know what it takes to make it taste the way it is. Anyone can learn it if they're willing to spend the effort and time learning. But it's not because of the region.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm starting to like the hypothesis that the best food comes from the most confrontational places.
So that's what I guess you're going
to
call my...
You need to have an attitude. Like, you need to have an attitude to make certain types of food. You have to have the attitude of wanting to punch somebody in the face for taking your parking space to make a Philly cheesesteak or a New York-style pizza.
I'll have the confrontational attitude of saying, like, if anybody, like, has my pizza, it's like, pretty good, but this is no New York-style pizza. I would kick the chair right from under them and then just kick them out of my store. It's like, fuck you! You're going on the wall of fucking shame. You will never be served in this restaurant ever again, you asshole! I take a photo of my foot on his chin and his, like, face down to the concrete, and that'll be the photo that goes on the fucking wall. It says, don't serve this fucking asshole, number one. And then it will go up to about maybe 200 or 300, and then people are like, oh, well, you know, I guess New York-style pizza is shit. Yeah, fuck New York-style pizza. And I will start a wave of knowledge. And I will start a wave of enlightenment. It's like, New York-style pizza belongs on the bottom of your shoe. I get it now, they'll say. How could I be so blind? Thank you, Bennett. And fuck you, New York. Fuck you and your pizza hierarchy. How's that for your confrontational attitude towards pizza? Something that should matter in this world.
Oh my God. Welcome to Big Benny's Bread Bodega. Just like, Jesus Christ. Wow.
It's like, few things in this world that are worth being in a confrontation over. Good pizza is one of them.
All right. You win.
Yes!
You win. I'm announcing on Toolshed. You win. Toolshed, the arena where arguments are settled for once and for all.
Two men enter. One man leaves. Man, so this is what having a Y chromosome feels like.
So, other things that we've been up to.
Oh, come on, man! I mean,
look, I cannot do an entire podcast on pizza. I can't. I can't in good conscience. Because what would the title be?
Pizza! Fuck you!
Teenage Mutant Ninja Tool Shed? Like, that is not the title I want on the site today. So other things that we've been up to, it's not quite anime month on Anime Abandoned.
It's actually fun.
And
as far as
it's an exciting idea, if only because it came from a really weird place. It came from The Real Adventures of Johnny Quest.
Yeah. Cause I remember you were talking about like the production, excuse me for a moment.
Cause you had never seen it.
No, I wouldn't have seen, I never saw it because I didn't have Cartoon Network when it was on.
So it came from this idea of like, what are we calling anime? I mean, if it's animated by a studio like Madhouse, is it technically anime, even though it's American produced, American written, and Japanese animated? What happened next after we started talking about The Real Adventures of Johnny Quest, which is one of my favorite shows because fucking Frank Welker is Jeremiah Surd, fucking evil decrepit Fred Jones, was the question kind of kept ballooning outward. It started with the pebble and the ripples just kept going. Like, is this really anime? Is this really anime? Is Spawn really anime? Because I brought to Bennett's attention the documentary Animation, Anime, and Spawn, which was a big deal when it came out just because, you know, they were trying to do it as a companion to Spawn. And it also kind of puts some weird stuff on the chopping block. Like, it puts Mass Effect Paragon Lost technically on the chopping block for not quite anime month.
But that one is a kind of a tougher deal to make because it looks like anime. It was animated in Japan, but just because of the whole American production angle, all of a sudden it's not anime anymore. That's just, like, there's no set in concrete rules as far as anime is concerned. I mean, even the term anime just means cartoons in Japan.
Yep. So we're in the thick of it now, where I'll do some confirmations. No, we're not going to do Avatar. Obviously, we already said that. Not going to do Korra. not going to do a lot of the things that people have been kind of like, yes, 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 for. We're not going to do Magus, at least not this year, even though that would be really fucking fun.
It'd be fun to do some of the suggestions. Maybe, like, not quite Anime Month 2 or 3 or somewhere down the line.
But, So, next is Lady Death, and the next is really weird and pissed Bennett off, so you get to guess what that was, and it wasn't Lady Death.
Wasn't Lady Death, although Lady Death, alright, I mean, here's a spoiler, it's fucking shit. I mean, I said, I'll spoil some of it right here, right now, I'll say that it is in my top 5, maybe 10 of the worst films I've ever reviewed.
Which, when you came up to Lady Death and you started watching it, and you just immediately started complaining because that's your new method now. Put DVD in, DVD is shit, start complaining to me immediately. I just kind of went, yeah, Chaos Comics isn't exactly a byword for quality. I mean, Chaos Comics may as well just have the tagline, Chaos Comics, because there's boobs in it and you're 15.
Chaos Comics, they won't card you.
Yep. Pretty much. I mean, like, with such great titles as Evil Ernie and Purgatory, Chastity, Vampirella, yeah, they're not really going to be the high mark of what we're going to be seeing as made for TV or made for or translated into movies anytime soon. Which, I mean, honestly, you would see Top Cow right next to him at that point. It's like, yeah, Dark Child. Yeah, that's not gonna happen.
But yeah, like, on one hand, when I was going into review mode for the movie, I knew it was going to be bad because what chance was there for it to be good? But you'd be surprised how shitty that movie is. And I remember one of the comments I was reading about on the Spawn episode was, it's a guilty pleasure. What is there to be pleasurable about this fucking movie? Enlighten me, please. Inquiring minds need to know. What is it about this vapid fucking 75 minutes that gives you pleasure, guilty or no? Yeah. I mean, is 2 plus 2 equals 5 all of a sudden?
Yeah, and I wish that we had more time for Not Quite Anime Month, or at least something to squeeze one more thing in, like Savage Dragon. That would have been really funny to do.
It would have been, but at the same time, as I've experienced writing episodes for March, series is not exactly a good thing for this episodic format that we're on right now.
Yeah, reviewing series is getting a shit ton harder.
Especially when you're talking about even arcs of stories. You're talking about an entire season or more.
Yeah.
I mean, go ahead. I'm sorry.
There's got to be an economy of the script versus, you know, like, what it is that we're going to do. Because personally, I think that Doug has the best format. Take a series, review the first 3 episodes, see if they hold up. I think that that's kind of brilliant. But the problem is that then you've got to commit yourself to an hour and a half of television, and you're not really getting the complete picture. Is that really fair to the series, as opposed to just watching the entire series and coming up with an overview of how the series performed as a whole?
Especially when you consider that the television series that he reviewed were episodic cartoons like Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles or Superman the Animated Series.
Yeah.
Whereas the series that I would review would have like an entire 26-episode arc.
Yeah, where everything's important.
Mm-hmm. So it's not exactly comparable, but we had a discussion about maybe doing something like that, but that would definitely limit the series purviews. Like, if we did that to, like, say, Ghost in the Shell standalone complex, we would only be limiting ourselves to episodes where it deals with the main plot over the arc. And that would skip over episodes that were certainly my favorite.
Which, like, honestly, because I keep coming back to standalone complex as... In terms of how they release those DVDs, how they release the original standalone complex, which I have in the steel box, with all the DTS 5.1 steel bullshits. and then they release the Laughing Man arc, which cut out all the filler. Mm-hmm. And they release the individual 11 box, which cut out all the filler. Which, I mean, it's really hard to defend Bandai's fucking pricing choices with a bullshit like that. It's like, if you want Ghost in the Shell without all the filler for $60, you can have the individual 11 box. It's like, so some of the best episodes that are on the second season, I don't get, but I get the entire individual 11 arc as one complete box set.
And one complete box set for the same price.
For the same, like, for roughly the same price if I'm a smart shopper. Great. Because I got the entirety of the original standalone complex off of Deep Discount DVD when that was still a thing. For about $50, and it was all the, like, special edition versions, and it came with all the, like, little figures and things, and I was actually really surprised. But yeah, so when I think about standalone complex, I start to think, well, we could just do the filler episodes, because the filler episodes turned out to be better than the overarching stories that permeated both seasons anyway, because, I mean, when you get to the end of the first season and it's Steve Bloom playing a little kid, you're just like, ugh. Cyber brain sclerosis can kiss my ass.
there are some parts of the last episode that I really liked. I liked how Togusa turned really fucking mental being cooped up in his home. It's like, that little fucking asshole stole my job. I'm going to murder him. And then all of a sudden, Bato comes out of nowhere. It's like, hey, man, what are you doing?
Yeah.
Oh, man, we were just kidding. We were just hiding from these guys. you should have seen your face.
We're totally doing this 24 Jack Bauer thing. It's cool.
No, this was really good. I mean, imagine for a moment if Togusa pulled, like, a Bruce Wayne confronting Cold, you know?
Yeah, it would be interesting.
Joe Chill.
it would be interesting to explore the less important episodes of Standalone Complex, if only because they had such interesting, funny, like, you know, like. Like, the terrorists don't matter sort of episodes. Like, what happens when a Tachikoma just kind of fucks off for a while?
And, like, how would you be able to tell, like, if somebody had your body, if somebody killed your original and pretended to be you? Would anyone really notice? Like, the Pazu episode.
Yeah, like, what was the episode with the hit woman who was, like, 50, but she was in the body of a 28-year-old or something like that? Like that.
Oh, yeah. Wasn't she, like, use money as a weapon?
I don't remember what her deal was, but I just remember it's like, okay, so she's like 50 or 60 years old, but she's in the body of this hot chick. All right, that's kind of fucked up and wrong and awesome. I love the sort of stories that Ghost in the Shell comes up with. That's amazing.
Like, Jungle Cruise is still my favorite episode of the entire series, and that was just as fucked up as you can get. Yeah, I mean, that was like...
What was the one with Saito, where he had, where it's like the first time that he came up against Kusanagi? And he had a staring contest with her.
Like, got a brass ball set on that woman to try to get into a contest with Saito,
like,
on that.
Like, the last time I had a staring contest with the Major, this happened.
I think that's...
Every time I have to take my driving test every year for depth perception checks.
Part of the series' charm was that the humor was so underrated. I mean, there was this great little subtle moment when the Major got thrown into garbage fighting an android, and she had to report back to, what's his name? Her chief, the chief. And she's in, like, this really skimpy outfit because she says she has no other clothes. And, you know, Bato's with her on the couch. And Motoko says, like, well, you know, the android was much more than we could have accounted for. And then Bato just says, you don't say. And there's this look on his face where, like, he knows he's under the Major's boot for a lot of the time. But this was, like, his one moment to get above her and just, like,
Yeah,
I wasn't in garbage. You were.
So we'll explore, like, maybe we can explore Ghost in the Shell this year, because we haven't banged out the entire schedule, and we can start working on those really fun, funny episodes, because there is a lot of humor in Ghost in the Shell that nobody really talks about. It's always about how, you know, like, yeah, cyberpunk and amazing and fucking naked. Like, you know, there's a whole lot more to it than that, and we can explore that.
Yeah, and there was also, like, some poignant moments that had nothing to do with the major plot, like the guy who put his brain inside of a tank.
Yeah. Fucking Revenge Road bullshit.
Mm.
But, and that's something else I want to do. I want to do Bubblegum Crisis.
Yeah, I mean, like, I wanted to do Bubblegum Crisis for a while, but the only thing that's ever stopped me from doing Bubblegum Crisis was the fact that it was 13 episodes long. I mean, for an OVA series, that's just breaking my balls here. I mean, I could barely handle 6 and put it in one episode, but 13? I thought we were, like, agreed a while ago that we wouldn't do, like, a two-parter episode. If we did Bubblegum Crisis, we would have to do a two-part episode for that.
Yeah, two-part and three-part episodes have gone the way of the dinosaur as far as the schedule goes, just because it's better to have single engagements, because we can't feasibly ask a new media audience to hang on for that long. I mean, look at it. We gave you half an hour, and that was just a little bit too long, and fucking Macross didn't work out exactly the way that we wanted it to, because we wrote it to be an hour and then split it into two parts thinking it would be okay, and the fallout was real steep. So it's just a matter of how many single engagements can we come up against before we kind of have to realize, like, okay, we have to break this up into two parts, because there's a lot that needs to be said about, you know, this type of series.
It's when you get to, like, 13 episodes. And let's face facts here. The longest episode, the longest single episode I've ever produced might be, the longest single episode, not the list, was either Fist of the North Star or Eight Man After, which were over the 30-minute mark. Yeah. And I'm not going to lie here, looking at the script for Lady Death, it might approach 40 minutes.
Which... still single engagement
the
trade-off is that these long single engagements involve more ads, and we apologize for that, but it's just kind of like, look, we like, if it's going to be this long, we may as well maximize revenue feasibly and across these extra long fucking episodes, because more time goes into making them, more time goes into writing, tweaking, filming, and post-production.
My theory is, or at least my, and not my theory, but my modus operandi as far as advertising is concerned, is that if my episode goes longer than 15 minutes, I put an ad in there. If it goes over 30 minutes, I put two ad breaks in there. And I always figured, like, 15-minute intervals is an acceptable, you know, ad break.
Yeah, and it's, like, and there's nothing really malicious behind it. It's not like, oh, like, let's, like, throw in all the ads. It's just like, eh, well, you know, proportional... You know, proportionally speaking, we're just trying to make sure that's like, okay, look, you know, you're gonna spend this much time watching it. We may as well try and spend this much time making sure that the bottom line gets that much bigger.
The only time I've ever gone against that was for the Apocalypse Zero script. And that was only because so much work went into that episode. Flash animation had to be done. Outside actors whose schedule, like Scott's schedule, was so booked solid for his work on DBZA that episode got delayed because of it. And it got to the point where we cannot have this episode be the typical one ad break, because it just, then the money we would get back would not have made the effort worthwhile. I mean, ask this guy about tweening animation and he'll tell you it's like, fucking.
Yeah, I am not Flash animator by trade. I am Flash animator hobbyist. So, and that, and even at that, that just took way too long, and I'm not, like, and I wouldn't say that Sensor Kaiser 2.0, that I nicknamed Laughing Kaiser, clearly, wouldn't ever talk again, because now we have an animatable Scott, so why the hell not? And, it kind of came from a place where people were, every once in a while, someone would complain that Scott's smiling head was horrifying to just kind of look at floating there. So Laughing Kaiser just kind of worked out a whole lot better as what started off as just kind of a really quick joke, but turned into, yeah, why not? Why don't we use this as the new Sensor Kaiser?
It was better because it was a more regular shape than a human head. So you could account for how much space that it would take up in the frame.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like, because Scott's head is longer than it is wide, so if you needed him to cover more width-wise, then you're kind of SOL. But as a regular circle, it would work to cover what it needs to cover, and not much else.
Although some people are complaining that the sensor Kaiser is too big, which that comes down more to, it's not the sensor Kaiser is too big, it's that Bennett is editing it too big, which that's just a matter of Bennett's discretion.
And my discretion is that I do not want a slight chance that that episode could be pulled due to Blip's, you know, rules. And truth be known, I could lower Sensor Kaiser to, like, basically cover characters' nips, what have you. But then you would have to account for, because it's so smaller, you would have to keyframe his face over every single frame of movement. And for some things that I do, that is not... For Apocalypse Zero, especially, considering all the things I had to censor in that, that would just not be... What's the word I'm looking for? Like, it's just not work... It's not spending their time working on it wisely. You are, like, counting bean threads when you can just, you know, weigh it, and then you still get the same amount.
Mm.
There are smarter ways to go about doing the things you need to do editing-wise than making sure that it covers the barest minimum amount that needs to be covered. And especially for that app, especially for Apocalypse Zero, there are things that you don't want to see.
Yeah, I really don't ever need to see that, ever. Yeah. Not the visuals, just like Apocalypse Zero as a whole. I never need to see it.
I remember you were, like, looking at some of the dailies of that episode, and you were, like, you were hearing my script, and you were liking my script, and then you were on the point saying, well, I don't think the character design is all that bad. And then, like, the big, fat monster woman showed up. It's like, oh, my God, fuck this show.
Yeah, because there's doing it to push the envelope, and then there's just pushing the envelope right off the goddamn table. You know, like, I'm thinking about character design now, and I'm just like, okay, well, I'll do this and this and this and this, and I'm having to, because I'm working on a project right now, which I can't talk too much about because there's just not too much to talk about, where Bennett and I are working on it, and we were looking over one of the character designs the other day, and the question kind of became, okay, so this character has armor, but there's no armor in this particular place, which I'm not going to name. And I changed some of the color keying around, and it fixed the problem, but it sort of did raise an interesting question, which is that if you don't put something somewhere and you as the creator sees it, is someone else going to see it? If they see it, are they going to, you know, like, is this going to be, you know, fodder for, you know, making fun of it, or is this going to be some sort of joke? Like, I mean, we all saw the new character designs for Sonic. And the internet just had a fucking field day with fucking, like, super hardcore jacked knuckles and fucking
workout bandages
and hipster Sonic, you know, like, and I'm thinking about that, and I just kind of, and I do kind of wonder, like, how does Dickman fucking design characters from such a secure headspace where he's not worried about people picking out the shit that he's not even giving two shits about. To the point where
self-delusion can be a powerful drug, man.
I know. It's hard designing characters, if only because, for me, it's hard designing characters just because I'm kind of sitting here going, it's like, does this look good? Does this look too much like this character? Am I, you know, am I not putting my own personal thumbprint on it? Is it too derivative? And meanwhile, guys like Dickman, they just design characters in their fucking sleep, and. You know, and they're not worried about, you know, what gets pushed or, you know, like, is this far too far? And I need that, you know, like, because I've got a shit ton of characters to design over the next few months. And I need that badly if I'm going to survive this process and this project, which we will illuminate you to as soon as we have anything substantial to show.
And I'm excited for it personally because this is the first chance to make something original.
And it comes from a lot of personal places in terms of why we're doing it. And there's a lot of things going on in new media, and I know what my place in new media tends to be. I know what my place is in voiceover, and I am I'm not really working a whole bunch. So when an actor isn't acting, he tends to write and create vehicles for himself. And I'm not saying that this project is going to be like the Mark show, because I am not that guy. I am not the guy who wants the Mark show. I don't want Mark fans. I don't want the Mark fan club. It's just something for me to do and to kind of put my flag in to the landscape. And it's involving a shit ton of work, but it's worth it, because at the end of the day, I'll have something tangible that I can kind of hold up and show and say, like, look, everybody, I did this just like you all do. You all create. I created something. That's awesome.
And you would hold it like Link holding up something you got from a treasure chest.
Yeah, I would, because I'm not an ideas guy. I'm a method guy. I'm absolutely the person that looks at the method and says, you're doing this and this and this wrong. But my inner child died a long time ago. I always kind of used as a point of reference my friend Chris Zito, who did our title card. To give you a kind of an idea, that Zito did the Toolshed title card inside of 10 minutes. And that's like, in his style is, it comes from a lot of places, but it comes from this awesome inner child that he has that he never let go of. And he has his own series that he's been working up and writing the Bible for, and he's been doing it for years and years. It's this massively epic tome that on his deathbed, it'll have like a post-it note on it for his children that says, not finished, keep going. I wish I had that, but I just don't. Which is kind of why it is that I need Bennett, because Bennett doesn't have a thoroughly crushed soul yet.
But you've been working on it.
Yeah, I admit to my hand in trying to make you as blasé as I am, but where my tombstone will say, Mark's, like, here lies Mark Swint, nonplussed. confused all the time at why you give a shit. So
no, let's not mince words here. You do have a sense that if you did have a creative spirit, you keep it tucked away.
I do. Because... And the reason why is because to create something is to take a piece of yourself, commit it to paper or to clay or to, you know, animation, and then you put it out there for the world to beat the shit out of. And me personally, I don't think anything coming out of my head is nearly worth public execution. Not really. So, but well, I'll take a shot.
And the way I've always put the creative process behind, you know, the bravery of exposing your creative ideas was the fact that, you know, I can't tell you how many times I've had something creative and I post it off of Mark, and sometimes he thinks it's good, sometimes he thinks it's bad. But the fact is that you cannot be afraid to be creative. You have to allow yourself the possibility that what you have inside your head may be a masterpiece to some, or could be just plain shit to others. But the fact is that you won't know until you've let it out in the open.
And that's what we're going to do. So over the next few months, we'll have something to show you, I hope.
Hopefully. I mean, as long as we get that keyboard fixed, right?
So long as we get the keyboard fixed, just to bring it all the way full circle. But I do want to announce what our production name is.
Oh, yes. Go ahead. This, all right, this is going to be an inside joke of a title. I mean, it's not going to be as inside jokey as, like, Victory Party at Spago's, or, no, Rap Party at Spago's. And if you do get that joke, then congratulations, you're part of the cool club.
Because sure as shit, we don't get it still. But we're going to be either Dr. Bear Pictures or Dr. Bear Productions. Like, what did you label the YouTube as?
I put Dr. Bear Pictures, because Productions sounds a little too generic.
And Pictures is just old school and classy.
Yeah, Dr. Bear Pictures. And the explanation behind Dr. Bear is, if you remember my very first, my very first official crossover with Spoonie as part of the Anime Abandoned umbrella, I mean, disregarding the precursors to that series, Space Thunder Kids and Garzy's Wing, you would notice, you would remember there was this bit where they talk to a character who is called Dr. Bear. And you remember that little visual gag where we zoom in on the fake name badge. That badge was created by my friend Mark here. And that was the very first time that he and I really clicked as far as, you know, throwing off ideas and being friends are concerned. It was sort of that defining moment. It's like, hey, this is a guy who I can talk to without feeling without any pretense of work behind our speech. Not like a lot of new media friendships can revolve around. Usually we don't talk to each other unless we want, like, hey, can you film me something? Yeah, thank you, man. You're good friends. Like, yeah. And that's, or at least that's what their relationship is to me.
It's like, Bennett, dress up as the devil. Say bad things. All right.
Okay. Did you catch that episode of Doctor Who last night? What did I tell you?
Yes, sir.
Where's my cameo?
Which, to be fair, I've had to kind of take that tone, although not as angry with some people.
Yeah.
Our new media presence isn't exactly known for our punctuality. But to get it back on track, this was, so Dr. Bear was sort of our, as Simon Pegg, it was Nick Frost who said it, who, when he first talked to Simon Pegg, he said that he made a R2-D2 noise, and that was him letting Nick know that he's a fellow nerd just like him. It was him spraying him with his nerd musk, and us bonding over that visual gag of a name badge was us letting each other know that what kind of comedy we like and what kind of references we like to make.
So
him being
that, that turned into Dr. Bear R. It needs to look official. What else? He works in the pediatric burn unit.
We had this such great time. I wanted a name that kind of reflected a beginning for the both of us. And that was, and it just happened to be Dr. Barry. And he had some apprehension towards it because he didn't quite know how that would sound to people who did not get the inside reference. So we bounced it off his girlfriend, and she loved the idea of a Dr. Bear. Just the idea of, like, a Dr. Teddy Bear. And so he drew, like, a little logo, and she fell in love with it. And it's like, well, if it appeals to people who don't even know the story, then I guess it is a good name and a good logo too.
And I still persist it's better than Bad Robot.
Fuck you, JJ Abrams.
I don't know why, just Bad Robot always seems like a silly title to me.
No, it's worse than, no, it's better than That's Some Bad Hat Harry.
Yeah, Bad Hat Harry Productions, that's a really bad one too.
Or I know I'm gonna get some flack for this because of the shows they produce, but I've always hated Sit Ubu Sit. Good dog.
Yeah. I mean, there have been some pretty bad production names. I think that as far as, like, production names go, I'm not going to say that Dr. Bear is, you know, over the fence better than every other one out there. But I'll say that, like, at least it's, you know, it's tied to something. It's tied to something interesting or that we find interesting. And that's the kind of coming together point is that Dr. Bear Pictures, because we find it interesting.
Dr. Bear Pictures. What? There's a story behind it. Ask us sometime when we're drunk. Or listen to this fucking podcast. What am I, your nanny? Fuck off.
Yeah, there we go. And that's the stake right there. That's the signpost. Like, you need to know what Dr. Bear is about. Go back to episode 20.
And I think that is a wonderful note to go out on. So, Mark, do what you do best and bring us on home.
All right. Outro music is always provided by Zero Reynolds. You can follow him on Twitter at Zerjester. That's X-E-R Jester. You can take Super Toolshed wherever you go. Just go to BenTheSage.com/SuperToolshed. For Ben the Sage, I'm Mark the Engineer. Until next we beat, the shed is shut.